listening to the JISC e-learning show, live internet radio. The JISC e-learning show, news, views, opinions about e-learning. Hello and welcome to the e-learning show. The e-learning show is a live internet radio program designed to bring you news, analysis and commentary on e-learning. My name is Graham Atwell and I'll be hosting today's show. The program is a pilot commissioned by the UK JISC e-learning program. And you can join in the show. Just go to our chat room at tinyurl/sounds08. I'll repeat that again. tinyurl/sounds08. Just go to the e-learning program chat room there, and Christina Costa's already there to greet you. Anyway, let's get on to the subject of today's program. The program is based around a symposium held by JISC earlier this year. Claire Groom from JISC Comms explains what the symposium was about, who was there, and how technology can support lifelong learning.
A lot of JISC projects touch on how technology can respond to the needs of lifelong and work-based learners. And as some of these projects came to fruition, we wanted an opportunity to share some of the findings and good practice with a wider community of people working in lifelong learning. We also wanted to provide an opportunity to discuss issues which still remain to be tackled and to consider what work needs to be done next. JISC is actually about to embark on a new suite of projects looking specifically at how technology can be used in lifelong learning and workforce development. So it's important that we're well informed from the outset of these projects.
Well, who were the people there, Claire, who attended the seminar?
There were a mix of delegates, ranging from teaching professionals to those who are involved in admissions, administration and student support.
And I suppose then the big question is, how can technology help support lifelong learning?
In all sorts of ways. Looking after students coming to education later in life and throughout life can be much more complex than dealing with the traditional student in their teens or early 20s. Lifelong learners are likely to have a wider range of previous experiences and skills, so the accreditation process can be more complex. Technology can help manage this process. Lifelong learners also tend to have a lot more extracurricular commitments that traditional students possibly don't have. So being able to get remote access, for example, to course materials, timetabling information, or even whole lessons, as and when suits the student, can be really helpful to lifelong learners. Without technology, much of this wouldn't be possible.
Thanks, Claire. In making this programme, I've been out talking to some of the people at the symposium. I wanted to know what they thought were the main issues raised about the project, their implications for the future development of lifelong learning, sustainability, and what it all means for policy development. I've talked to people from a range of professional backgrounds. I must say I was surprised at how the practical project development was throwing up issues for policy and vice versa, how policy and planning issues were impacting on the work of project teams on the ground. I was also surprised at how much agreement there was about what needed to be done. Anyway, you can listen for yourself and make your own judgments. In the last part of the programme, I'm going to be talking live to our panel, Oleg Lieber from CITIS, Claire Newhouse from the National Lifelong Learning Forum, and Andrew Ravenscroft from London Metropolitan University. If you'd like to ask a question to the panel or just express an opinion, here's how you can do it. You can leave questions in a chat room and Christina will try and do her best to summarise them. Or go to the e-learning blog. That's at http://elearning.jiskinvolve.org. and just leave a comment on the entry about this show. Or you can email me. My email address is graham10, that's graham, G-R-A-H-A-M, 1-0, at mac.com. Or you can Skype me. My Skype name's easy. It's just Graham Atwell, spelt with two T's. You're listening to the JISC e-learning show. We're going to take a short musical break now, and then we'll be back looking at some of the issues raised by the symposium. Hope you enjoyed the music. I suppose when I set out to make this programme, I thought most of the issues would be around technology. And indeed, there were issues raised around the technologies we are developing and testing. But most of the people I talked to were raising wider issues, particularly around work-based learning. Yes, sure, technology could help address the needs of work-based learners. But if it was to be effective, it required wider actions. Indeed, the issue of change and how to manage change seemed to be one of the main concerns, both from those coming from a policy direction and from the project developers themselves. One word which kept recurring was culture. Here's Derek Longhurst from Foundation Degree Forward.
One of the things that is important about work-based learning is that it is challenging to the structures, systems, procedures, cultures of higher education institutions in many different ways.
Okay, but what does that mean in practical terms? Sandra Wingfield from Nottingham University has been working with employers introducing e-portfolios and other technologies for work-based learners.
I think one of the issues for work-based learners and possibly for vocational courses as a whole, rather than more traditional academic courses, is that everything needs to relate back to the real world and it needs to relate back to their actual workplace competencies. And if employers are paying for their staff to undertake some sort of training or education, they're expecting results that are tangible and relevant to the work that they do. And that's quite a big challenge for, well, certainly for us as a research-based university, where we're interested in, or we have a lot of experience of doing more blue skies type stuff.
From a practitioner's point of view, or rather from project developers, I suppose the way this sort of issue impacted on them was when they wanted to make things change, particularly introducing practices and technologies in novel ways, or ways that haven't been done before. Lucy Stone from Leicester College explains what happened when she tried to introduce a chat room for a work-based learning programme.
Another thing we tried, which was a bit contentious really, was to open a chat room for the cohort of students on a Thursday evening at about 8 p.m. And the tutor volunteered her time initially to do this. And they could come in and chat in the chat room with the tutor sort of midweek. And it was used by about 6 out of, say, 11 students regularly. And we can now print all those conversations off and sort of battle now with perhaps managers. And it has been a bit of a battle, but it's getting recognised now institutionally that that should be recognised as class contact time.
I think all the project managers I talked to were very enthusiastic about the projects they were taking part in and about the benefits of new technologies, and actually quite optimistic that they could manage change processes. Here's Lucy Stone again.
I don't think it can be a problem. I think it's about informing and engaging perhaps senior managers of an organisation in what you're doing. and making them realise what the benefits are to the students. And I think when you spend 10 minutes setting up a chat room, which is how long it took to set up, another half an hour to train a member of staff on how to use it, but then have feedback from the students that that midweek conversation motivated them to carry on with their studies, they can see the benefits of something like that. So it's just about changing and adapting a culture of understanding how technology can be used in learning.
Now, in a moment, I want to go on to look at some more of that technology and how it's being used. But first, let's just hear once more from Derek Longhurst on what he sees as the benefits of getting involved in work-based learning and technology as well.
I think there's a way in which, in the 21st century, within the context of a knowledge economy, work-based learning is very much in line with what most universities would regard themselves as being set up to deliver, I think, to employers. Technology can support, very importantly, work-based learning, and in lots of ways can be very integral to that whole experience where you have people, as we are currently, speaking at a distance from each other. Consequently, it creates communication channels, opportunities for discussion and debate and exchange across different parts of the country and different kind of communities of learners who may be operating in at a distance from each other. And that's an important aspect of what technology can do, not just a current two-way process between an academic tutor and a student in the workplace or an employee. It's actually about the employees themselves or the students on a program being able to establish their own communities.
We're going to have a short musical break now, and we'll be back with more on the JISC e-learning show. Okay, in the next section of the programme, I want to look at the learners. There's been a lot of debate about what skills learners have, how prepared they are for the digital age, especially since Prensky came out with his digital natives idea. And since then, a lot of people have said, no, this isn't true, really. Learners are quite heterogeneous. So who are the learners? What's their previous knowledge and experience of using computers? And what's their particular needs? And I suppose once more, what's the implications for the way we design and manage learning? Here's Lucy Stone again.
There were some students who had done an OU course before. There were some students who had techno joy, and there were some students who I would say were technophobes, definitely. And one student who didn't have access to a computer at all, which was an assumption of mine that's now gone. I just assumed everyone had access to a PC these days, and she didn't have one access for one at home or in the workplace. So we had to think about that as well.
Bob Bell also cautions against making easy assumptions.
A lot of the kind of hasty assumptions you might make about IT skills can easily be overturned. I mean, for a start, certainly there are quite a few people coming out of sixth forms who've managed to avoid touching computers for their entire life so far. That might be a diminishing number, and hopefully it will be, but you can't assume that even 19-year-olds are competent with everything. But even more so, I mean, the whole business of work-based learning, of course, is upskilling or reskilling, working with people who have a job or who are currently between jobs. And the work-based learning provision is there to improve the capability for more responsibility in the workplace, or to move from one lower level kind of level of responsibilities to something higher. So I think you can't assume those people necessarily have come into contact with lots of technology, and you still need the old remedial class, if that's the way to put it, to try and bring people up to speed with use of social networks and general desktop skills to make sure they're competent. So, yeah, you can't assume too much. Some of the JISC projects I looked at certainly recognise that and have put on specific tutoring arrangements, face-to-face activities to get people to the speed they need to be to work with technology satisfactorily.
And as Sandra Winfield says, it's all too easy to assume that everybody is used to the new kinds of Web 2 technologies that we're using so often ourselves today.
We talk a lot about Web 2 in project work, about Web 2 and formal and informal learning. But again, we make a lot of assumptions about what people are using. And while there is a very high proportion of individuals who are using lots and lots of different tools and lots of bits of mix and match technology, there's also a lot of people who aren't and find it faintly frightening, or have a tendency to find a tool they like and cling to it and use it regardless of whether it's suitable for what they're trying to do with it.
But it's not just in technology that work-based learners may have particular needs. There's other things around the nature of the curriculum, around the nature of the workplace.
First of all, they are likely to be what you might call a negotiated learner. So the curriculum, even the delivery style, could have been negotiated as an individual or as a group of corporate workers, you know, operating with one particular employer with whom the university had done a deal. So that might be a very specialized bit of a negotiated curriculum. It could include, for instance, the achievement of credits, not through conventional forms of delivery and assessment, but by a genuine work-based approach of the sort you get in apprenticeships, that is evidencing the achievement of a skill that's actually been acquired in the workplace. Very different kind of competence kind of world, if you like, to that which pertains on campus. So very much of the style of the learner could be, of the learning environment could be negotiated. The form in which the learning is achieved and assessed could be quite different from the expectations in HE. So that's just a start. Then you've got the fact that they're off-site, they're perhaps isolated. They will need the classic distance delivery of conventional material. Perhaps they will need constant communication and mediation from a tutor. They will need to attempt to try and meet as a group electronically, perhaps with webinars and other forms to help conference together in pursuit of some discussion and agreement. So all of that, if you like, is not necessarily what you would meet in respect of a learner who is conventionally full-time on campus and able to interact with tutors and fellow learners in a live situation.
But things are changing. Tony Toole from the University of Glamorgan has noticed a marked change in the technology that students on his work-based learning programmes.
During the 2 years of the project, we saw a dramatic change in people's use. It was becoming more and more used. The more popular social networking such as Facebook and Bebo and YouTube and Flickr and so on. So my expectation is that it will gradually become part of the communications mix and document management, resource management mix that is available to online learners. And I'm sure it's also going to impact on the way campus-based learners access and communicate. So I think the impression we get from the project is that sustainability is almost inevitable.
By the way, if you're interested in knowing more about Tony Toole's project, or indeed any of the projects referred to in this programme, you can find full details and addresses on the e-learning blog, http://elearning.jiskinvolved.org. It seems to me they all share a number of things in common. Many of them are working in networks, particularly the lifelong learning networks, or in partnerships between FE colleges and universities. There's a variety of different technologies being used. Some of them are using e-portfolios, both for supporting work-based learners and for personal development planning. A number of them are looking at social networking technologies, others are looking at mobile technologies, and there's quite a focus on how we can provide information and guidance to learners. All of them were involved in practice, working with learners, not just blue skies dreaming or developing technology for the sake of it. And most of them focus on pedagogy just as much as they do on technology. Sandra Winfield has been working with the Derbyshire and Nottinghamshire Lifelong Learning Network and has been involved in a variety of projects looking at e-portfolio development. She explains how they've been using e-portfolios with plumbers on a vocational programme.
We've got a very successful pilot running with a group of plumbers who are using their e-portfolio, again, as an information, advice and guidance tool almost. There's a big push to upskill plumbers, the plumbing workforce. There's a lot of plumbers around who are, well, jobbing plumbers. And increasingly, they're being asked to provide some sort of credential. And one of the Lifelong Learning Network's projects is getting plumbers to use to evidence their learning and try and get them up to level two and then point them towards level three.
Of course, e-portfolios are hardly new, but there's still a lot of issues involved in implementing them in practice. Usability remains an important issue.
What we've done is built a front end on the e-portfolio which holds their hand. And what it's done is broken down all the skills and all the competencies that they need for level two and given them examples of what sort of thing that might be. And then that's linked to an e-portfolio at the back end where they can actually store their evidence. And what's actually happening is that plumbers are looking at it and discovering that, in fact, they've got a lot of these qualifications, a lot of these skills already. That because the examples are there and because it's been broken down into small steps for them, and very specifically because it's being expressed in language they understand.
The JISC e-learning show. As I said in the introduction to this programme, one of the things which quite intrigues me is the cross-fertilisation between policy, practice, technology in this area and in these projects. Clive Church from EdExcel is totally convinced of the e-portfolio approach.
There also needs to be a culture within all students, all ages, to record achievements as they go along. And these are students who are at school, are students who leave school, go on work experience, students who become apprentices. So that when they want to participate in higher education, they've got some kind of portfolio with loads of evidence to say, look, I can do this, I can do this, I've proven I can do this. And it means that they don't have to sort of waste a great deal of time going through sort of theories and practices, which they're already quite adept at already.
But of course, this begs some questions. What exactly is a e-portfolio? What does it contain? What's its purpose? How can we make e-portfolios interoperable? And what about that unique student number? Here's Bob Bell.
What I've had to think about over the last few weeks and months is what's the market for and how would you sustain an institutionally independent learner record, which will be available to institutions who are about to recruit you, will be available to employers, and perhaps available to clients if you're self-employed, and that whole concept of something which is a combination of personal achievement together with a showcase and a record of what you've actually been doing. I think first and foremost, we'd have to settle on a unique learner identifier. Been playing around with that for a long time now, and I think it's going to take a bit of policy and a bit of urging and pushing from the likes of Hefke and Diaz and so on to get institutions to begin to use and to depend upon the unique learner number. And so that's one step. I think the other difficult step is to recognise that these kind of personal record having multiple purposes with multiple views, if you like, and multiple concerns, it's quite difficult. I think my general view at this stage is that there's probably no single definition of a portfolio which is satisfactory for all the different possible purposes. What you might achieve is the standardization of elements or subcomponents of it, so that you've got kind of a guaranteed, verified credit record, which will be obviously looked after by an institution, but could be embedded within your personal record, but you can't fiddle with it. There might be another area, a rich area, where you can develop your showcase.
Another theme being addressed by many of the projects was advice, information and guidance. How could students make informed choices? And of course, there's plenty of information out there, but is it useful? Here's Sandra Winfield about another of her projects.
There's lots of information, there's a limited amount of advice, and there's very little guidance. And that's still the case, I think. There is, one of the issues with IOG is that there is heaps of information, an enormous amount of information, some of variable quality and variable use. One of the things that we see in IAG focused technology as being useful for doing is to focus learners on the useful resources. The classic example of 14-year-olds going away and typing engineering into Google and just getting thousands and or millions of hits and not having any idea which ones are any use. The technology that we're experimenting with and the advice tool that we started to build as part of our Joseph project is run at a higher level by IAG staff, so that they can quality assure the links that come through it. And so there's some sort of guidance almost in the information that's coming through.
Progression routes was yet another concern being raised. Both progression routes to higher education and the ability and the flexibility to be able to drop in and drop out of both further and higher education and to raise skills levels through a lifelong learning strategy. Here's Clive Church from EdExcel.
I think the major challenge, I think, is for getting appropriate progression into universities, especially for folk who have come up through sort of competence-based educational routes, like those who have taken national vocational qualifications, for example. The APL processes tend to be very clunky in most universities, which often means that students have to start again.
What of those APL processes then? Many of the people I talked to raised concerns that the procedures really weren't working. Here's Sandra Winfield's take on it.
We're finding increasingly that one of the big barriers for work-based learners is this difference in language between learning institutions and employers, and indeed the people themselves. So a lot of these plumbers will look at a list of competencies that come out of an NVQ qualification and just be blank. But if you can break it down and express it to them in terms of, well, okay, what this means is you can change a washer on a tap, they then realise that they've got most of these skills already, and the APL process to get them to the point where they've almost got their level two becomes much more straightforward. And there are also big problems around QA with APL as well. So you can get people to produce evidence, but the bit that takes time is measuring things that are enormously different against some sort of common standard.
A number of the projects I talked to were looking at how we can use mobile devices to support learners.
We worked with a group of students who are on a foundation degree in educational studies, and they all come to college for 4 hours a week for a twilight session on a Monday afternoon. And for the rest of the week, they're working in the workplace, which is early year settings like primary schools, special education needs settings, and nurseries. So we were looking primarily at them using mobile devices that they could take into the workplace to record things that happened, really, so that they could have an opportunity to reflect on their practice when they had an opportunity to sit down and perhaps do some of their coursework, which might be sort of 3 days after doing some theory in the classroom. But out of that, we set up a Moodle site for the students to use. They didn't have anything prior to the project starting. And within that, we used some tools within Moodle to support the students further, which came out to be a big success.
We're going to have a short musical break now, and we'll be back with more on the JISC eLearning Show. In Wales, there's been a long development of partnerships between universities and further education colleges to extend learning in the workplace, particularly to small and medium enterprises. Tony Toole, who's working with Glamorgan University, has been looking at how to use mobile technologies and social networks to support learners in enterprises.
We were exploring the use of mobile technologies and social networking software as a way of enhancing the tutor support of online distance learners who were primarily work-based learners. We were particularly interested in supporting SMEs in rural Wales, and that's where they were. The learners that we were dealing with were scattered all over Wales. We were delivering online through Moodle, and the mobile side of it saw us linking Moodle with an application which sat on everybody's mobile phones, which enabled them to communicate with Moodle. So they were able to get information and interact with Moodle from their mobile phones wherever they were.
One of the big issues emerging for work-based learners is the sheer time commitment. How do you hold down a full-time job and do a college course at the same time?
Work-based learners, as you'll know, are jockeying their time around work commitments and home commitments as well as learning. And so anything that makes it more efficient and flexible, they welcome. So they welcomed the immediacy of the mobile phone, the fact that they got, whenever anybody, for example, posted a message on a forum to which they were contributing, they would immediately get a message saying that that was the case. They didn't have to be at a computer or anything like that to get that information. And they could actually, respond to that. They could contact their tutors, and it improved the tutor response times as well. They liked that, where they might post a query on a forum. They might get a message within 5 minutes from the tutor saying, got your message, we'll be responding. And they really liked that.
But of course, the use of personal technologies does raise new issues, particularly for learners and for tutors, really.
There were aspects, as you might imagine, of using personal technologies. For example, at Merthyr, both with the mobile phones and with social networking software, where they had a Facebook group that they were using on their learning, there was a common agreement amongst the learners not to involve them at all after 9 o'clock at night, because they wanted some time when they weren't getting SMS messages about their course and people banging up their Facebook account or whatever.
Yet another concern which came out of the seminar and out of the JISC projects was the issue of engaging employers. A particular concern was the recession. Would employers continue to be interested in partnerships? Would they want to promote work-based learning? Derek Longhurst is quite upbeat about this issue.
We have found that with this recession, there is a very noticeable difference amongst many employers in many different sectors. Now, you are largely talking about the large employers, but essentially, we have repeated evidence, substantial evidence, that those employers want to retain their best staff and recognize that retaining their best staff and actually coming out of the recession more competitive and more, if you like, able to deal with the challenges post-recession, they are looking to an investment in education and training rather than just simply cost-cutting exercises.
Lucy Stone thinks employer engagement starts at institutional level, but JISC projects can help in this process.
I think you start at institutional level and talk to, if you have business development managers, and get them on board. And if that doesn't work, then perhaps think of ways of engaging people in business and industry by perhaps talking about your projects and what you hope to achieve in industry journals by contacting them directly and perhaps talking to other JISC-funded projects who have done similar things and gone through a similar journey.
Tony Toole believes we need to talk about the benefits to be gained from engagement with projects and institutions.
It was easier than you'd expect, certainly with the first part of the programme, because we were dealing with SMEs, so that the employer was also the learner in many cases. And the way we targeted the SMEs, the first thing we did was to go and visit them physically face to face. And we were able to do that because it was a project, and to talk to them about the company and to talk about how e-commerce in that case might benefit them. And so the engagement was through selling them the benefits and the fact that they may, they would actually gain in business competitiveness as a result.
One prevalent theme which underpinned a lot of the discussions around the issues was that of sustainability, or what JISC is now calling benefits realisation. How could projects continue after the period of funding had ended? And even more, how could that project work be disseminated or really embedded in continuing ongoing practice? Here's Derek Longhurst.
The point about JISC and the initiative issue was that there was some sense, at least from some of the delegates, that when the money dried up from JISC, then so too did the project. And so there is a significant issue there for JISC about embedding and evaluating projects to ensure their sustainability beyond the lifespan of the particular funding arrangements, I think.
Sandra Winfield looks at the same issue from the perspective of a project, but she sees the answer as in getting the products actually out there and used in the community.
Sustaining things beyond short-term programmes. I mean, it's. I think this is an issue for all project work, really. It's that sustainability once the initial interest in project funding is finished. It's giving something, and this has been the big success of Joseph, that's been taken on by the local connections service, who are actually building it into the offering that they're going to offer to all the Nottinghamshire schools. So it's keeping the impetus going so that you don't then end up going back to the beginning again, or if not back to the beginning, sort of taking two steps back every time you go into a new project.
Rob Ward sees the problem slightly differently. He thinks it's an issue of connecting up between pilot projects and between the mainstream. He sees mainstreaming as part of a change management issue.
I think there's a different set of dynamics when pilot projects and enthusiasts are involved to when you're trying to roll out whatever it is, actually. It doesn't have to be portfolio technologies, but let's just stay with that. When you're rolling that out to academics who have many different concerns and interests and motivations, and students who probably need to be inducted effectively into seeing how this technology can work well for them in a context where they're doing lots of things, or can be doing lots of things technologically outside of a university or a college. The change management issue might rely on the formulation of stronger alliances, firstly with those folks who've got an interest in pedagogy and in the effective use of technology to promote learning, and also a sense that there needs to be a bridge between the enthusiasts and the leading edge technologies back to where institutions might be. So it's a question of how we help those people who are in a sense in the mainstream to really make use of technologies.
Visit the e-learning blog, http://elearning.jiskinvolve.org. And finally, before we go to our panel, of course, there's the issue of policy. Many of the people we talked to raised the need for changes in present policy, changes they thought were pointed to by the different projects. For Derek Longhurst, it involves re-looking at the whole widening participation agenda.
There are many people who don't see three-year on-campus higher education as for them. And they often are people with qualifications who could go on into higher education, but choose not to do so because they want a different kind of higher education experience, and one that is more work-based and that is supported by an engagement with an employer. And so there is a whole issue here around widening participation and diversity in higher education that institutions need to face. That whilst much of the very valuable work that's gone on in widening participation access over the last 20 years, significantly broadening the scope of higher education in terms of engagement from different social groups, that nevertheless, work-based learning and developing partnerships with employers can add a different dimension to much of the work that has been focused on keeping young people in school and college and on into university, which has been the dominant trend, if you like, in terms of widening participation.
Nigel Ecclesfield from BECTA thinks JISC needs to get more involved in the policy agenda and thinks we need a feedback loop between practice and policy.
A good example came up in yesterday's meeting of the difficulties that FE lecturers and colleges have in funding the assessment of e-portfolios by FE staff, because depending on the interpretation you have of different policies and funding practices, some people get paid for it, some people don't. But I think those sorts of distinctions that are made by policy have outlived their usefulness. And I think it's about listening more to learners at one end so we can give clearer messages to the policymakers at the other, and that we get a feedback loop in policymaking rather than one that at the moment seems to funnel top-down, with JISC caught as an awkward intermediary sometimes between practitioners and institutions, when really sometimes the game we're in has been set outside those parameters and needs to be addressed with the policymakers to get them to think through the consequences of the decision around which we have the real evidence to show whether or not certain policies are working.
Clive Church from EdExcel expressed a concern that many of the practitioners I talked to really were worried about.
Sort of recent government policies, especially with dealing with the expansion of applications into HE and the sort of capping of funding, could well lead to sort of additional initiatives to deal with work-based learning actually being cut.
And in relation to the progression agenda, Clive Church saw the answer as ring fencing of Hefke funding.
Yeah, I think what they could do is ring fence some of the Hefke allocation to make progression easier, to actually support the development of APL tools, which could say provide students with sort of questionnaires, so put the responsibility on the student to be able to say yes. There's a kind of tick box. Yes, I can do that. I can do that. I can do that. I can do that. And then if they've got the evidence, then if ever they're needed to confirm that they've got that experience, then they can sort of bring that on. So those kind of APL tools and that kind of ring fencing, I think, would be important.
Many of the practitioners I talked to were concerned that the funding models were holding back the development and implementation of e-learning and many of the new approaches to using educational technology for learning. However, Tony Toole also acknowledged that we needed to learn more about how these new models could work and how funding could support such models.
The kind of work that we're doing at the moment, the funding models that support it, are not really well established. There are parts of the funding regime which deal with distance learning and open learning and e-learning, but without those methods being, I think, properly understood and researched in terms of their costings. And therefore, I think there's a way to go as far as the public funding of this kind of delivery before we get to the point where we can say that we understand how it works and how the funding follows that, and have a real understanding of how that compares with conventional funding and conventional delivery.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to this programme about these issues, and in a moment you're going to have your chance to put your questions to our panel. But before we go over to the panel, I'd like to give the last word to Mark Stiles.
As someone who's been in e-learning rather a long time now, I've rather come round to the view that we've had a tendency to use technology to produce a generation of learners who are poked at and monitored and intervened with more than ever before. The whole concept of ownership of the e-portfolio and the one that always worries me is exploiting informal learning are things that are interesting. To me, you know, it's my life, it's my portfolio, it's my informal learning. What happens to it should be my business. We've had a tendency to use technologies to exploit them for the benefit of the organisation, yes, far more, I think, than we have for the benefit of the learner. And I think there's a real opportunity now with changing technologies and a realisation that new models of learning, like work-based learning, give us a new way of looking at the world, to stop doing that and use technology to enrich the life of the learner.
Mark Stiles sums it up nicely for me there. OK, please don't go away. We'll be coming back with the panel discussion in a moment. And don't forget, you can still email, Skype, or add your questions into a forum, and we'll be putting them to our panel. We'd like to know what you think about today's show. Go to the JISC e-learning blog, http://elearning.jiscinvolve.org, and tell us what you think about the e-learning show. JISC e-learning show, and this is your host Graham Atwell, and this time we really are live internet radio. I hope you've enjoyed the program so far. This is the final section of our program. We've got our panel today, and I've got live with us today Claire Newhouse. Hi Claire.
Hi.
And Claire, you're from the Lifelong Learning Network Forum.
I am, yes. I'm representing the 30 Lifelong Learning Networks in England.
That's great. And we've got Andrew Ravenscroft from London Metropolitan University. Hi, Andrew.
Hello.
And we've got Oleg Lieber from CTIS. Hi, Oleg.
Hi there. And I'm just representing myself today.
Well, I think we're all representing ourselves on this programme in some ways. We've had a pretty lively chat going on. The questions are still coming in, and if any listeners want to add questions, probably the easiest way now is to go to our chat room, which is at http://tinyurl.com/sounds08. The chat room there, you can ask your questions in there. Okay, a few questions came in earlier. Let's deal with that ULN. Oleg, I guess you're the standards man here. Could you tell us what a URLN is and what you think about it?
Well, I think the idea of a unique learner number is that that everyone in the UK will have one, and then it makes administrative life much easier for people who are concerned with these sorts of things to be able to, you know, track people's for people to be able to find their achievements, their portfolios, and so on. Personally, I think there are kind of big problems with this kind of approach, even though the government has kind of seems to be behind it, because I think it simply stacks up. It solves an immediate problem and stacks up problems for the future.
And it's those consequences which run out over time, which is always one of our worries.
Absolutely, that's right. Because, you know, learners are becoming global. So will I have a French or a European unique number and a Chinese one when I study there? And, you know, will all our foreign students have to acquire new numbers when they get here, etc.?
Yeah, I can see the problem. So technology on its own may not always be the answer.
No.
But surely having one number is preferable to having a range of different numbers across the FE and HE sectors?
And I guess that's a bit of a question about identities, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, I think the real question is, you know, why do we need them? You know, who needs a unique learner number? Who benefits from it?
I think it's being touted around as the answer to e-portfolios between institutions in different phases of lifelong learning. But is it the wrong answer to the wrong problem?
Well, lots of people would argue that e-portfolios should belong to the learner. And if, you know, I think the problem is that we're very worried about people behaving irresponsibly and claiming things that they shouldn't claim. But, you know, we've kind of managed that world for a long time. And I just wonder whether this very heavy-handed approach is the way to go. It's the same thing as ID cards. You know, it falls into the same category of attempts to fix small problems with great big solutions.
Okay, let's move on a bit. Claire, there's a bit of a question I'm going to address to you first anyway, which has come from the chat room. Ian from Scotland, I think he was from Scotland, he asks, will VLEs and established e-learning technologies meet the needs of work-based learners? Your view on that one?
It's an interesting one. And I think it's one way to obviously reach those that are in the workplace, but you've got to understand the different types of environments that these new learners that we're trying to engage with are working in. I think there is an issue as well around the support for work-based learners and if the established systems or the current systems can actually support learners out there in the workplace and actually enable them to feel like they are part of a true learning experience, like maybe a traditional full-time learner does.
Very much. Anyone else like to comment on that one?
I worry about the way that we reify learning as being the important thing that we want to get people to engage with, rather than actually turning the thing on its head, and you know, and actually thinking about actually the person's work problem, you know, fixing their problem at work is where the learning happens. Actually, in the future, I think people will be more concerned with their work problems, which are fixed by learning, rather than worrying about achieving learning to fix some problem which they haven't yet got. Do you see what I mean? And I think that we need to go to them, you know, or at least they need to say, I'm stuck with this. I can't do this at the moment. Can someone help me? And that's when the intervention happens. So the focus is very much on fixing work problems rather than on the kind of certification idea that we're really stuck with at the moment.
And Andrew, I know that you're involved in a major European project called the Mature IP. Isn't that looking at some of this issue of knowledge development and knowledge maturing in workplaces?
No, I think that's exactly right. The perspective that Oleg's mentioned there, that what we're trying to do is somehow bring conventional assessments of learning into the workplace, where really what we should be looking at is in fact, a term of yours, Graham, is learning-rich working. In other words, how can we get learning from work practices and how can we foster learning that's productive and generally leads to improved competency or improved understanding? And maybe that's the real issue, rather than how we actually assess it or certify it, which, as you say, I think is very much part of the philosophy on the Mature project.
One of the big issues which came up when I was doing interviews for this programme, and by the way, I'm going to release all the full interviews as podcasts, which will be on the e-learning blog, because there was a lot of stuff. It was very difficult choosing what to include in that section earlier. But there's the whole change management strategies, and especially the mainstreaming. There seemed quite a lot of concern about moving beyond projects into a more mainstream practice in the use of technologies. Anyone like to comment on that question of mainstreaming, and I suppose it involves sustainability and change management as well?
Yeah, I mean, I could comment on that. And what springs to mind to me is the Grolsch advert, that in terms of mainstreaming, I think people, you know, I think this is the GISC are guilty of this. The assumption is that everything is done on a large scale straight away. So the change management, and you know, the sort of revolutionary change, if you like, and a lot of revolutionary agendas. Whereas in reality, if we want to introduce an innovation, if we start off with good pilot projects that have a high impact through some action research and then build on those, that, you know, a more sort of systematic and long term approach than this more revolutionary agenda approach. I think that's
But Andrew, isn't it also being said that GISC has funded many, many innovative projects, but when the project funding ends, so do the projects, they don't go anywhere.
No, I think that's right. I think the key thing there is to actually, it's for people who, and we've tried this ourselves with projects, where we've had people who are genuinely not project staff, but are people who've been bought out to work on projects, but are still within the institutions. That is where we get some sustainability. So the critical, and I think that's actually a nice model where it's not project staff and it's a buyout of staff within the university who are committed to a project, but for whom there's a natural join once the project ends to continue the innovative practices they've been supported, that they've been doing, really.
Yeah, I'd like to bring Claire in here, because Claire, presumably your Lifelong Learning Network Forum has been concerned with some of these issues.
Yeah, I mean, we've been concerned about the sustainability of our networks in general, and a lot of the networks have drawn down separate funding from GISC and other sources. And they've been concerned with how they embed the practices for aiding progression, looking at how we can support vocational learners accessing the work-based learner from the very beginning. So actually, a lot of the practices that have been developed around e-learning, they've started to look at embedding them within partner institutions from the beginning. And that's actually proving to be quite a benefit at the moment, because some of the partner organisations are then agreeing to sustain things by paying a subscription fee on a partnership level. So it's not just one institution signing up for a particular element, it's a number of institutions all joining together to take forward some of the systems.
Yeah, and Oleg, you said at the beginning, when you were talking about the unique learner number, that we're solving problems now, which are problems now, or trying to solve problems of the past. But I suppose the thinking is then we should be introducing ideas for the future. And that brings us on to, where's the trends? How are things changing? What's the issues you think we should be concentrating on now?
I think we're facing another moment, which is a bit like 1994 was, where, you know, the web suddenly made everything different. Now we find ourselves in a situation where technology is very rich, but institutions still are, to a large extent, not very different to you know, how they've ever been. So I think culture change is probably the biggest issue. Now, what I would say, however, is that there's no divine right for any new idea to take hold, you know, and I mean, in a sense, this follows on from the last question, you know, that GISC funds a lot of things, and it has to be very strategic, I think, in thinking about which things have got legs, have got value, and are worth continuing to invest in until they take hold and are sustained. Mm-hmm. Now, this is very, very sensitive. Obviously, there's lots of viewpoints and there's lots of stakeholder positions. I think it's you know, that's probably where we need to be putting a lot of attention over the next period.
And I see Ronan is just saying the future is where learning is outside the institution.
What I would say is that the role of the institution has to be very carefully examined. I've been an Illich fan for many years, as people who know me know. However, institutions are very important. In that they are currently, it's the only way you can get state money into education. Now, you know, you do away with that, get another mechanism before you get rid of that. Otherwise, we'll be in some horrible right-wing kind of free-for-all.
And a quick word on the future trends, Andrew?
To come back to sustainability, I think what Oleg's saying is important. It's hard, and there's no divine right to ensure sustainability. But come back to your the immediate question. I think the future's uncertain, but I think part of the answer to that is almost came out of what Oleg just said, that what work in the future will almost come out of a more realistic attitude to what actually takes ground and develops. In other words, to maximise technologies that are genuinely life-changing and liberating, we've got to accept that we're going to make some mistakes, and some things will fly and some things won't. But I think the idea of learning slowly migrating outside of the institution to being leveraged off working rather than imposing practice on learning is so I think the future is almost a change in mindset, I think, about how we conceive of education rather than one, a revolutionary technology suddenly taking root.
And Claire, I'm going to give you the last word because we've got to move on. We're overrunning already. I'll give you last word on this trends. Where do you see all this going? Are we in a 1994 moment, as Alex says?
I would definitely echo what's just been said, and I do think there is a large role for GIST to take the lead on those things that are succeeding. I think there are some things that need to be developed around the information advice and guidance, and specifically around the guidance. And I think that there needs to be more that's focused on that element for learners, in my view.
Okay, well, thanks to the three of you for agreeing to come on the programme tonight. It's been great having you. We're going to go into another short musical break. Then I'll be coming back telling you about future events, or rather, Claire Groom will be telling you about what's coming up. Okay, into the music, Dirk. Show. Okay, we're coming to the end of today's programme. It's been a lot of fun making this programme and a lot of problems on the way as well, but it's great. I think one thing I'd like to emphasise is this is a pilot programme and we'd very much like to get your feedback on it. Did you enjoy it? What worked for you? What didn't work? Did you like the music? Did you like the format? How do you think we can grow such a programme in the future? What do you think is the potential for it? And we'd like to leave your comments, if you can, on the e-learning blog. That's http://elearning.jiskinvolve.org. And Claire Groom, who's been a lot of help to me making this programme, is just going to tell you about a few up-and-coming events. Claire, following on from this radio show, how can listeners find out more about GISC's work in the area of lifelong learning?
Well, of course, we're hoping that everyone will carry on the discussion on the e-learning blog. And as you've mentioned, that's elearning.jiskinvolve.org. You don't need the www bit to get into it, just to mention. So. There's also a detailed report on the Lifelong Learning Symposium that started all of this discussion off. And there's rather a long URL to get to it. So I'll pop that up on the blog to make it easier for listeners to find it. GISC's new improved website also has lots of information on lifelong learning and work-based learning. So best thing to do there is just to go into the GISC homepage, which is jisc.ac.uk, and to type in your search into there. It's particularly worth keeping an eye on the work being done as part of JISC's new institutional innovation programme, which has a number of projects that relate to lifelong learning and work-based learning. And again, I'll put some more details on the blog about that for listeners to follow. The other thing that might be of interest is to come along to see us at this year's HE Academy conference.
And what's going to be happening at the conference then?
Well, we'll be launching our new Effective Practice in a Digital Age guide, which looks at various scenarios common in learning and teaching in today's digital environment. There's also lots of really useful online resources that go with this guide, such as podcasts and video case studies. Also at the Academy Conference, we'll be highlighting some of the work we're doing to support educational institutions in developing relationships with businesses and other external partners, which obviously is very useful in the sphere of lifelong learning and work-based learning. So there are plenty of resources out there and plenty of work that JISC is still doing in the area.
Yes, and I've been looking at some of those resources myself, Claire, and I'm a bit overwhelmed, I have to say. There's certainly plenty out there. So thanks very much, Claire. Plenty to look at.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, that's the end of today's show. I've just got to thank everybody. There's so many people to thank. Thanks to Claire Groom and Paul Bailey from JISC, who have been great to make the show with. Thanks to all the people who agreed to be interviewed and to our panel members. I know it takes a lot of time to contribute to shows like this, and I really appreciate all that you've done. Thanks to Christina Costa forever for being in our chat room and hosting the chat today. And of course, great thanks to my producer, Dirk Stierglitz, who does the real work behind the scenes while I just have to sit in front of a microphone. If you like the programme, you want to hear it again, it's available, it's going to be available for download off the e-learning blog. And so are all the interviews with the different people who came on the programme earlier. And as I say, we only used a tiny bit of the material we had. It was a terrible job trying to cut down and leave stuff out, which I think would have been really valuable. But you can get those all as podcasts from next week. So that's it. The JISC Learning Show, the pilot edition. Please try and give us some feedback. It will be very helpful for us in trying to develop some ideas in the future. And over, I suppose, to our last piece of music. Oh, I should have told you, the music. We hope you like the music. It's all Creative Commons music. The artist is Da Capo, who I'm told is French. The album is Musiques en Principauté de Boisbel, and you can find it on the wonderful Creative Commons Yamendo website. That's www.yamendo.com. Okay, good night to you all. The JISC e-learning show was produced for JISC by Pontedusky. It was presented by Graham Atwell. The producer was Dirk Stierglitz. The JISC e-learning show is licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike license.